We are going to be talking about, not no, 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 but yes, yes, yes. We're going to be talking about the new law passed in California, Yes Means Yes, on college campuses. And with us to talk about this very interesting new law is Ann Mitchell. Ann, welcome to the show. How are you?
Oh, thank you so very much for having me.
Ann is a lawyer. She's an advocate, a policymaker, speaker, educator, and author in the area of gender law and policy, among other areas, father's rights, parenting issues after divorce, and children's rights. Ann and I are both members of the Leading Women for Shared Parenting, which is an organization that recognizes that children need both parents. You have been outspoken on this issue, this law that was passed in California. Let's talk a little bit first, Ann, about what actually this law does.
What this law does, and if I can just take a moment to even give a little bit of background, last year there was a letter that was sent out. You may or may not know about it. It came from Washington, and it was now known as the Dear Colleague letter. And unfortunately, the author escapes me at the moment, but it was sent out to many, many institutions and lawmakers across the country, basically insisting that universities institute Yes Means Yes policies. And so that is how this all sort of started to bubble up. And California was the first state to actually rush a bill to committee and ultimately to be passed. And what this bill, first of all, what it's supposed to do is to address the very real issue that on college campuses there are far too many incidences where, after the fact, it is discovered, if you will, that maybe the woman kind of capitulated. She didn't really want to have sex, or maybe she was inebriated and so wasn't capable of giving adequate consent. And so the purpose of these policies that are now being enacted, again, across the country, is to try and address that situation. So that is what this bill was intended to address. What it actually does is it does create that sort of affirmative, it's called affirmative consent. You must consent affirmatively. It isn't enough that she didn't say no, she now has to say yes. However, the way this particular law is worded, it is, as I say, it's a license to accuse. It is worded so poorly that it is already basically assumed that if a woman says, hey, I didn't actually want to do this with you, I did it anyway, but, you know, I really didn't want to, that if she levels that accusation against someone in the university setting, that man against whom she's made this accusation has absolutely no protections whatsoever. There is no requirement that they be allowed counsel. There is basically no requirement at all for what should happen in terms of protecting the accused.
And I'm going to read a little bit from the statute, the law. Affirmative consent means affirmative, conscious, and voluntary agreement to engage in sexual activity. It is the responsibility of each person involved to ensure that he or she has the affirmative consent of the other or others to engage in the sexual activity. So it almost, I mean, we all know in our legal system that a person is innocent until proven guilty, and that a criminal defendant really has no obligation to prove anything and can, in fact, produce no evidence, can, in fact, not testify, and the prosecution must prove beyond a reasonable doubt all of the elements of whatever that crime is. This law, and I'm with you, Anne, I think there's a serious problem on college campuses when 1 in 5 women are saying that they've been sexually assaulted against their will or without their consent. But what do we do then? Does that make the guy, I'll say it's the guy because I don't think it's going to be enforced the other way, does that make the guy then have to prove that there was some sort of affirmative consent? Does that put the ball in his court now in a way that really kind of turns our law on its side?
That's exactly what it does. And again, and you know, I actually have examples. There have been several lawsuits, not under this particular law, but under very similar policies, and even in California. And the one in particular that I, you know, not only am I familiar with it, but your listeners can actually Google it and it will come up, is a lawsuit against Occidental College, which is in Southern California. And in that case, and this just kind of goes to show how this is really just a pendulum swung too far, and it's this sort of witch hunt mentality. In this particular case against Occidental, the evidence showed that the young lady who later, and I mean, this is my own take on it. I call it revisionist history. You know, she had regrets after the fact. And so she went in and was sort of coached. Well, gee, you know, it kind of sounds like this is what happened to you. Oh, yeah, that's what happened. But the evidence shows that they had an agreement. The boy and the girl had an agreement that they were communicating by text message as she was walking over to his dorm room, that she was texting her friend saying, hey, I'm on my way to so-and-so's dorm room and we're going to have sex. And even with that evidence, he was suspended and I believe ultimately expelled. This is a young man who had a spotless record and who had intended to go into the field of diplomacy. And now his college career and indeed his entire career is ruined because of this allegation.
Go ahead.
In that case, I don't think I'm conflating cases. I believe it was in the same case. They actually used the fact that he came from a good family and had a spotless record. They somehow made that be evidence against him.
I have handled cases on both sides. I've handled cases where women have been assaulted and want to get it prosecuted. I've handled several cases for young men in colleges under these very similar circumstances. And one of the most bizarre circumstances that I've seen that is very common is what happens is both parties are drinking, you can imagine, and the woman goes into what we call a blackout mode, where she appears to be consenting and she appears that she wants to do that. And she appears to even say yes. And she appears to participate. But later she says, I drank a half a bottle of vodka and I was in a blackout state and I have no recollection and I certainly couldn't have given my consent. Well, the problem with that, and I get that, the problem is, how does that young man know that when she, by all appearances, looks like she's completely fine or at least not drunk enough to give her consent? And again, I had two boys. Again, the same situation for you. They were expelled from the university, even though they were never prosecuted criminally, and they lost tens of thousands of dollars in tuition payments. And that is always going to be on their record, and it's something they're going to always have to explain.
And it's heinous. I'm not at all surprised, but I'm very disheartened to realize, you know, I've been in this field for going on 25 years, and it really has not changed very much at all in that time. And it's a very bad time to be a young man. And in fact, as I said in my testimony when I was testifying against the bill in the California legislature, I said, I would never allow, I have a son, he's 16, he's starting to think about college, I would never allow him to go to college in a state that had a law like this, because under the reading of the law, if you actually give that law a strict reading, he could get expelled for kissing his girlfriend on the cheek if he doesn't ask her first, each and every time.
It is frightening, and there is also going to be a problem of proof, because the girl may not remember. The boy may not remember either, but how do you prove, and who is proving what happened on that night when, you know, in college campuses, these things happen and they happen quickly. Again, the best policy is to refrain from having sex with somebody you don't know, who's not a steady girlfriend or boyfriend. But we all know that this kind of stuff happens. And when it happens, it should be a mistake that is acknowledged and that is learned from, but not something that ruins somebody's career and the rest of their lives.
And you're absolutely right, because you say, how do you prove that? And the way this law is written and the way the policies are now being instituted across the country, either on the legislative level, which we're looking at here in Colorado right now as well, or just on the university campus policy level, that in each one of these that I have seen, there is absolutely no burden of proof on the accuser. There is no requirement for evidence. So when you ask, well, what's the proof? How are they going to prove it? Well, the way it's looking, she doesn't have to prove it. She can just allege it, and that's the end of it for the guy.
And I got one quick question before we go to break, and I hope you'll stay on with me.
Absolutely.
Just putting you on the spot, you're not a legislator. Maybe you've not thought about this, but is there any kind of law or rule or something that would help both sides of this, will not put young men in a situation where they're at risk for wrongful prosecution and expulsion, but also that will protect girls in the situation where there really is some sort of forced sexual contact.
You know, I'm really glad you asked that, but it's a huge sore spot with me, because when I testified in Sacramento, and I was the only one there with my background in opposition, and that was the first time this committee, it was the Education Committee, had heard this. And at the end of my testimony, at the end of all the testimony, all but one of the committee members echoed the concerns I had raised, told the senator, Senator De Leon, that they had these concerns. And during my testimony, I offered to work with them. I have a legislative drafting background. And three of the senators urged him to take me up on that offer. And I ended up drafting a model law, which they never even looked at. He did not take me up on that offer. But so, yes, absolutely, there's a way to do this so that it does protect both parties. And I believe the model law that I wrote does that. But, of course, Senator De Leon couldn't have cared less, because he was just all about, you know, going with the constituents, which are primarily in California, for him, the women's groups.
And again, I'm all for the women's groups. I'm all for women, and I've been an advocate for women in these situations forever. And frankly, when I was in college, I saw it all the time. Okay, I was a resident advisor. I saw all kinds of unwanted advances and that kind of stuff. But again, this is just overkill. And, you know, to make a law because it's a feel-good law and it appeals to certain groups is the wrong thing to do, because, as we know, this could become also a very expensive proposition, in that I don't even know if it's constitutional. I don't even know that it's going to be sustained when it comes to the court's attention, and it's going to. It's absolutely going to be challenged. I would be a lawyer who would challenge that in a second.
And I think that you're right. I think that actually when it does get the appropriate and correct challenge, it will fall. I should also say that the two people who testified after me were not there strictly in opposition. They were on the opposition side. They were the representatives from the two main California university systems, both of whom said, we have not even had a chance to look at this. So we're not supporting it, but we're also not supporting it. But it still got shoved through.
And thank you for joining us. But let's talk a little bit more about children's rights, parents' rights, and father's rights when we come back. Can you hold on?
Absolutely.
All right. Ann Mitchell, thank you for joining us. And let's talk about men and women divorcing, children, custody, those types of issues. Are the laws pretty much across the board in this nation gender neutral when it comes to issues of who gets custody, who gets parenting time, and the like?
Well, I hate to sound like a lawyer here, but I guess that really depends on what you mean. If you look at the actual words of the laws, you know, they never usually refer to mother, father, or genders. But in terms of application, absolutely across the board, they are still extraordinarily biased against fathers.
So that's the first thing I just wanted to establish, that some people still hold the idea that the law will say mother does this, father gets to do this, mother. There's nothing like that. It's and there are courts that find custody for dad, and that mother has to pay child support, and vice versa. So let's talk a little bit on what is the cause of these gender-neutral laws being interpreted in a way that favor one side or another?
Well, you know, there are several reasons and causes for this. A lot of it has to do with just how entrenched the concept that, you know, there's something called the tender years doctrine, which was, you know, many, even decades ago, that went, you know, the thought was that children of quote-unquote tender years, meaning younger children, belong with the mother because mothers are more nurturing, mothers are, you know, somehow intuitively more able to parent, you know, and there's this idea that there's this maternal bond that is just completely natural and so strong that, you know, a father couldn't possibly hope to approximate it, which, of course, we know as thinking people is not the case. And the reality is children need access to both of their parents. But again, you know, the family law system is an adversarial system, which is just the wrong place for a family that's disuniting to be anyway. But if there has to be a quote unquote winner and a loser, then for the most part, you know, the courts are going to stick with what the status quo has been. Typically, not as much now, but even now, a bit, you know, it's the mother who is the one who's home in the early years, if one parent is home. And courts don't like to mix things up at all. They're very comfortable with, hey, it's probably the mom who ought to have the kid.
On the other hand, you know, as you know, in reality, when a family is intact, the mother is at home with the children if she's a stay-at-home, and that's sometimes the case, and sometimes it's the dad who's at home, and the mother goes out and earns money. But when the day is over, the dad is home every night, and the dad is eating dinner with the child, hopefully, and the dad is maybe helping get the child ready for school the next day and is home when the child is sick. So just because the dad is working during the day doesn't mean he's not spending quality time during the week and during the weekends with the child. So even though it's the status quo that mom is the primary caretaker, by giving dad his every other weekend and maybe one day a week, which is sort of a standard parenting schedule, is really taking a lot of time away from the parent and child.
Absolutely. And you know, another aspect of this is that guys, and I saw this, you know, I had a private practice strictly for fathers and family law for many, many years, and I saw this over and over and over, which is, you know, there's this sort of social contract that you enter into that, you know, dad is the one, you know, typically, again, you know, if one parent is out working and one parent is home, typically it's dad who is out working, and he's holding up his end of this social contract or social compact, if you will, that his job is to go out and earn the money to support the family. And, you know, and as you say, he comes home hopefully for dinner, and he's around on weekends, but his sort of primary job, and this is how boys are still raised in our country, and this is what men internalize, you know, I'm a good father because I'm providing for my family by going out and working. That is my job. And then what happens when a divorce happens is that very thing that he was doing, that he knew he was being a good father by going out and working, that very fact is held against him because now they're in court and it's being said of him, well, he was never home during the day because he was out working. So, you know, it's this double-edged sword, and men are often just blindsided by this fact.
You know, it's really amazing that when you get a divorce, you think of divorce as a process. If you really think about it, you got married to somebody, you love somebody, you had children with them, you're raising children, you're getting a divorce, you shared everything, now you're breaking it all up. And the first thing you do with this very volatile, very important dynamic is you're telling someone they've got to file a lawsuit against their spouse and allege that they are not a good parent if you want to get custody of your children. Custody, of course, being a bad word, too, because that sounds like they're in prison instead of parenting time, which is now what we're using. But the idea that you have to just lodge all kinds of complaints against someone to say they're, you know, mentally cruel or all those things is just so antiquated and so wrong, because what we should be doing is bringing parties together to work things out without the court process really interfering with it.
Absolutely. And, you know, I am a huge proponent of what I call co-parent counseling and of mediation. And, of, you know, basically my forte when I had a private practice was keeping my guys out of court, because it always worked out better for everyone involved if the parties could get to a point where they could go in and sit down with a neutral third party without the outside influences, which, you know, one of the things that happens very frequently is that if mom is starting to, you know, say, oh, yeah, we should be cooperative and maybe we can do this outside of court, then what she starts hearing from her friends and her family is, well, you shouldn't do that because, you know, he's going to take you to the cleaners and he did this and he's a no-good so-and-so. And there's all these outside influences sort of fomenting the case, so that if the couple can get to, you know, again, a co-parent counselor or some sort of neutral party that can help them be in a place where there are no outside influences and they are actually free to talk with each other and come up with a parenting plan together, usually, I would say 9 times out of 10, they are able to do that, and it is a much better solution because they've had a hand in creating it, and they're much more likely to stick to it, and the kids have this model now of, hey, even when parents divorce, they can still co-parent, and generally it's just so much better if a disuniting family can stay out of court. And just one more point about that, as I'm sure you know, generally speaking, courts love it when the parties come up with their own agreements, and they can agree to just about anything, and the court will happily sign off on it and make it an order.
I always tell my clients in divorce settings that whatever decision you two make, however strange it is, however, you know, as long as it's for your kids' best interest, you know, you're so much better off making that decision, giving up a little bit, taking a little bit more, to giving up a little, because when the judge a state employee with a robe on who may or may not be a parent, who may or may not have any experience with children, with psychological issues, with family issues, makes a decision, you're stuck with it. And he or she is the wrong person to be making this decision. And once you get away from the confrontational stuff, obviously divorces are fraught with problems. I mean, the issue, you know, you wouldn't be getting divorced if you didn't have serious issues. But when you can get a good mediator to get the parties together for the kids, everything else, you're right. He's a cheater. You know, she's this, he's that. Okay, forget it. What we're talking about is Mondays with dad, Tuesdays with mom, or whatever. And you start talking about the nitty gritty of how to raise children. You know, it does put the focus on a different place. And it is wonderful to see parents who you think are never going to agree finally come to some agreement and put it to rest.
It is absolutely wonderful. And, you know, actually, this is the topic of my next book, which is about divorce, you know, how to be divorced as parents. Because about a year ago, it hit me that, you know, the generations prior to us, like you're in my generation, our parents basically were setting the example for how to be in a marriage. But our generation and generations forward, because of the high, high divorce rate, we are essentially setting the example for our children of how to be divorced. Whatever model we're setting for our kids right now is what they're going to do for our grandkids. And when you think about it in that light, it's really sobering. And
it's frightening.
You know, people really need to think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's frightening. But if you can get people to realize that, you know, I've seen that actually help them to sort of ramp it back down and go, okay, yeah, maybe we need to figure out how to cooperate.
Absolutely. And we've got to go now. But thank you so much for joining us. If people want to read your books, I know you've got a bunch of them. They're on Amazon. They're all over the place. Can you give out your website and spell your name for us?
Absolutely. My website, my name is Anne, middle initial P. Mitchell, A-N-N-E, P. Mitchell. And that's my website, annepmitchell.com.
Thank you for joining us. I hope you'll do it again.
I would love to. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take care.